You're listening to By the Well, a podcast where we discuss the lectionary readings to help you preach in your contexts. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And this week is Easter 6. We've got readings from 1 Peter chapter 3, along the lines of comfort in unjust suffering, Acts 17 and Paul's sermon in front of the Areopagus, and John 14, verses 15 to 21, the gift of the advocate and abiding in God. Psalm 66 is also set this week, and we might make a brief reference to that. Now, these are all rich texts as they were last week and could be a focus alone. But just for the purposes of some summary, we're hearing the mixed experience of the first Christians in these texts in their encounter with the wider community. So Paul's model of a sermon in Acts seeks to use the words and categories of the local Greek pagans to talk about the lordship of Christ, though he never mentions the name Christ. And this reading, along with the psalm, which is a summons to the nations, sort of seem to undertake an apologetic task, so making the faith credible to the outside world. And the gospel and epistle focus on the needs of the Christian community themselves in offering pastoral consolation in times of suffering. So I think we'll begin with 1 Peter, as is our short-lived tradition in this little series focusing on 1 Peter.
Which begins with a rather ridiculous question.
It does. Thank you for saying that. Now, who will harm you if you are eager to do what is good? Plenty of people.
Plenty of people in the world. Yes.
You just need to watch the news most
nights. Have you met other humans?
Yes. Yep. So we'll just leave that there. And
it's hard to know what that's doing. I think it's an appeal to maybe an ideal that if you're doing what's good, nothing bad will happen to you. But very quickly this author acknowledges that actually people suffer precisely for doing good and for being Christ-like.
Now, I am interested in the second part of verse 14, do not fear what they fear. Do not fear what those who would hurt you fear, which is an interesting one because if they're bullies, then bullies we don't tend to think are fearful, but, of course, beneath the bullying is insecurity and fear. And do not be intimidated. Now, my understanding is that refers to a passage in Isaiah, specifically Isaiah 8, 12 to 13. So Peter's not just talking about some sort of popular wisdom that might reassure you not to fear, but actually the quote from Isaiah is, do not call conspiracy all that this people calls conspiracy, and do not fear what it fears or be in dread. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall regard as holy, let him be your fear and let him be your dread.
I think Peter here is picking up on a theme that we see just, you know, throughout this letter of one of the ways Christians are distinct from the world is not behaving in some of the ways the world behaves. And you know, there is a bit of a them and us thing here with Christians expecting to live these holy lives, imitating Christ. And so the contrast to that in the way he frames it is that being of the world is perhaps in this case being fearful, but being malicious, retaliating, returning violence for violence, slandering others. And if you think of some of those bad acts, if you like, being malicious and slandering, often those are ways people lash out of a place of fear.
Yeah. I'm thinking too in our current context, we hear a lot from our politicians and from media generally about fearfulness and, well, about fear. We are made to fear that there is not enough of something.
Yes.
You know, we live in a world of lack and so on. Whereas the Christian gospel is that God provides abundance and we are given the good gifts, which is a very different message. So I read this verse also to be, don't be sucked in by the propaganda of the age, which wants you to be fearful of things that actually are quite ephemeral and will make you competitive and go against your fellow human.
Yes.
Instead, direct that fear to God, which again needs unpacking. We talked a bit about this on our Easter podcast with Craig Thompson about the fear of the soldiers. But I remember Craig talked about, you know, as humans we fear individual scary things, but the fear of the Lord is a very different order of
Yes, that's like fear. A reverence and an awe. For God.
Yep. Yeah. So I see Peter here doing that reminding again, as you indicate, of you're a different people. You've got a different place of belonging, and don't let the fears of others be your fears. And then a reminder of their identity, which comes from sanctifying Christ as Lord in their hearts.
Yep.
So that holiness.
And that's the source of their hope.
Yeah.
I do like this little commission in verse 15 here, to always be ready to make reply or to give an account to anyone who asks you to explain the hope that is in you.
Mm.
And the assumption there is that people can see the hope,
yeah,
but that somehow you are living in such a way that your hopefulness, your rejection perhaps of being sucked into the fear-mongering of the world and this competitive, you know, building up or storing things. I mean, we've seen this in this outbreak, right, with the toilet paper hoarding. Mm. And I did rewatch the movie Contagion the other night.
Oh, did you?
Which is all about a...
Sandra Bullock, is it?
No, it had Gwyneth Paltrow. Oh. And it's all about, it, scarily correct in some ways, a pandemic that breaks out that also has a sort of a Chinese point of origin but is far more deadly.
Mm.
And one of the scenes is just showing people panicking when everything gets locked down and literally... you know, breaking into supermarkets and stealing things off the shelves and hoarding them for themselves and the violence that breaks out, that in a sense is the logical outcome of fear and maliciousness and getting, you know, just only looking out for self. Mm. Like that can take
survival.
You down.
Yeah.
So the hope, I think, is the antidote to that here, hope in Christ as Messiah.
Mm. I'm reminded of a recent popular text by Lee Sales, actually. Mm. She wrote a book, Any Ordinary Day.
Yes.
And she's trying to reconcile really difficult times she's had in a particular year of her life. You know, a day begins ordinarily and then absolute trauma and crisis occur in the form of a diagnosis or an accident and the death of a loved one or near-death experience. And she talks to over half a dozen people from walks of life. We may have heard of these people in Australian cultural context. But there is an Anglican priest represented in that book. And I feel like he was giving an account of the hope that is in him without using those words. Mm. He suffered multiple grief, I think. I can't quite remember. But Lee's posture in the book is very gracious and interested.
In what sustained him.
She's interested in what sustained all of these people and about human resilience and so on. But I did feel that this particular priest's response was giving an account of the hope,
yes,
that is in him and through the faith.
Yeah, that's a great example. And I mean, and this idea that we must be ready to explain that suggests that we all, you know, we need to do some work. That's being conscious.
How ready are most of us with the words and the lack of embarrassment that requires? It's for me, I think, to give an account of the hope that's in me feels not easier. I don't mean it is easy, but compared to talk about the faith and what it means to you, it's a bit like an exam question.
Yeah.
But giving an account of the hope that's in me, I feel like the words would flow more naturally.
Yeah. I've been on a similar vein. I've been reading Julia Baird's new book, which is Phosphorescence.
Right.
And it's about finding joy in the midst of hard times. And, you know, she mentioned some of her hard times in that book of a significant relationship breakup, her own battle with cancer, and what brought her joy and sparked joy. And it's sort of a series of essays and reflections. And one of them, she talks about the perspective that astronauts have from space, where the world suddenly looks so small.
Mm.
And there's a word for it it's like the overview effect or something, where being reminded of their own smallness, but then the wonder and grandeur of the world gives them a sense of awe that can be quite transformative. And it made me think about the perspective faith gives you. Mm. I think when we spend time in these biblical passages, we have this sense of the grand stories. We're reading here stories of generations of Christians before us who have suffered.
Mm.
And it can give us a sense of just a much bigger picture of human history and of what God is doing.
And that it's not all up to us.
Yeah. So there's a sense of our own smallness in that story that perhaps quite counterculturally gives us a sense of awe and a perspective that actually can sustain us.
And then there's that beautiful paradox in the tradition and in the text where God knows every hair on your head or knows you since you were knitted in the womb.
In Jeremiah, yeah.
And yet you're a holy nation.
You know? Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
It's that juxtaposition.
It is.
So the other thing I'd want to highlight in this passage too, so there's some points from Peter here about ethical living in the hardship. But then that verse 19. So we've moved on to, so you've got ethical tips for living in hardship, but then Peter's moving on to the foundation of Christ and Christ's suffering and resurrection that gives you the strength and the vision and the identity to withstand this. And in his account of Christ, starts verse 18, for Christ also suffered for sins once for all, the righteous in order to bring you to God. He was put to death in the flesh but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison who in former times did not obey, etc.
I know, wonderful little verse.
Oh, my goodness. This has spawned lots. So people, I must say, my eyes did glaze over when I'd read a particular commentary on all the things this could mean.
Yes, lots of theories by Scott.
I have an understanding that I think is quite compelling for
do
it.
Do you, Fran? Tell us your understanding.
Well, I think it's saying that, as our creeds declare, that there is nowhere Christ has not been, and in his death he descended to the dead, to the harrowing of hell, and maybe did some preaching and embraced the story of salvation that far.
Yeah.
But, you know, no, far be it from me to.
No, I think, look, there are numerous theories. I mean, there's a couple of things I'd want to say about this passage. Peter is very precise here about what he means by suffering. And it's not just generic suffering. It is quite particularly suffering for faith and persecution. So that it's just, and he'll talk in other places in this letter about what suffering is not. If you're suffering because you did something bad, that's not worthy suffering. You know, he makes some distinctions. But here I think in this verse 18, 19 about the journeying to the spirits in prison and then this reference to Noah, which is creative biblical hermeneutics going on here for Peter that
he's doing a bit of systematic theology, I think.
Yeah, the family the of Noah narrative. That were saved from the flood is just like the rest of us in baptism. I'm like, I didn't quite see that link, but
well,
okay.
Well, we're saved in both. Humanity's saved in both. Yeah,
it's pointing to God's ongoing. But I like in what you say, like there's echoes behind this perhaps of Enochic traditions, of the primordial traditions in Genesis pre-Noah, and this sense of, you know, can the reach of Jesus or the reach of the salvation of Jesus be offered retrospectively to those who've gone before?
Mm.
And I agree with what you're saying in essence, Fran. I think, like, not to get bogged down in the nitty-gritty of that, if you want to, you can go read some long pages of academic articles. But the point is there is nowhere that Jesus has not gone, even into the realm of the dead.
Mm.
And I think the hopeful promise there is that, you know, even beyond time and space, you know, if we think of time as constructed, there is, you know, if the realm of the dead includes all generations of millions of people before us, there is also nowhere the gospel can't reach.
No, and John's gospel, which we're currently looking at in this part of the lectionary, begins, in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God and the Word was God.
Yeah.
You know, so that pretty much embraces all of existence as we've known it.
Yep. And, I mean, it's worth saying too that Origen and Augustine, there are several of the early church sort of grand theological thinkers would reflect on this verse and use it to talk about the possibility of universal salvation and the reach of salvation beyond the grave. So, you know, it's
which is quite a popular area of theology at the moment. There are people writing, like David Bentley Hart.
Yes, about rethinking hell and notions of salvation and hell. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I quite like it, but it is, again, I think this is the kind of stuff that puts people off preaching the epistles, because there's a density of images here that can be a bit weird and unwieldy to work with.
But pick one and you could,
yep.
You know, you could unpack some pre-existing understandings and not quite right and open up some liberating ideas. Yeah.
And, I mean, right now, again, in this current climate, if your message was there's nowhere that Christ has not been and cannot go, and that, you know, this is God abiding with us into wherever life and death takes us, that is a word of both hope and promise.
And I'm reminded too that N.T. Wright has just recently written an article that I think was in the Washington Post or the New York Times. I can't remember which.
We'll pop it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. But he is saying it's not Christianity's vocation to explain suffering. And in these times, particularly pertinent where people are getting sick and dying all around the world. And he talks about the Christian response being the reminder of the abiding presence of God and Jesus with us everywhere, particularly in suffering.
Yeah.
Which
segues us into John quite nicely.
Yes, I think the readings today all are a reminder of that truth and of that comfort.
Yes. If we move on to John 14, starting at verse 15, this is where Jesus promises the paraclete or the advocate, depending which translation you have in front of you, a reference to the Holy Spirit, this word that means intercessor or mediator, helper, comforter, counselor. And I think the key thing here is that little word another. He says, I will, ask your father, he will give you another advocate. So this is someone like Jesus in role and function. And again, it's a sense of continuity here with the abiding presence of Jesus.
To be with you forever.
Yes. And this lovely image of a promise not to leave you orphaned, not to leave you bereft, not to leave you alone.
Yeah.
Again, goes with what we were saying before and with that N.T. Wright article you referenced, that the promise of God is to be with us. That's the constant. The reliable presence of God. The world can go keep crazy on. And we can't control it, try as we might.
Yeah.
But the constant, what faith gives you, I think, is a reliance on the abiding presence of God, even when everything else changes.
Yeah, and can offer a vision and strategies for living and a vision of your identity that allows you to live hopefully and realistically in a world that we can't control but which is shaping us. See, and that's something that, Peter's community, back to Peter, but they're being deeply shaped by the rejection and the uncertainty of the world around them. That is a reality.
Yeah.
But the scriptural good news, the message, the gospel is God is with us. And that it's something that can sound, it's a bit like saying God is love. It can get really trite.
Yes, it can.
But it's actually a highly complex, profound, that it's a preacher's task, or maybe it's for every Christian, to work out what that looks like and what that means today, tomorrow, this week. Yes. What does that even mean?
Because we can say that, but what does it mean and how do we stop and pause and notice God with us? I think to say God is with us and that God promises to be with us and that God is faithful to us in the sense that God doesn't just vanish doesn't mean we don't have to do some work in pausing to notice, in pausing to be with God in a way that actually makes us attentive and tuned into the presence of God.
Well, and other passages like the Road to Emmaus, which indicate that we recognize God retrospectively.
Yeah, often after the fact. Yes, yeah.
No, so yeah. It's none of it's tidy, but that is the abiding truth. That is the reality of our lives. You know, we talk about normality when we go back to normality in all of this. And, well, maybe for a Christian, we think of normality in a different way. The normality is the enduring presence of God in what predicament we're in, and learning to speak that meaningfully and truthfully with all its ambiguity sometimes.
Yeah. And perhaps another normality, and this ties back to a theme we've been tracing for a couple of weeks and we're not quite done with yet, I think, in the lectionary, is in terms of our identity as Christians and a core part of that being imitating Christ.
Mm.
One of the verses that really struck me rereading the John passage was 21. They who have my commandments and keep them are those who love me. And it ends with, I will love them, and I don't love the NRSV translation here because it's something more like be manifest in them, be revealed in them. So there's a sense again that our Christian identity is this to carry Christ, that when we are like Jesus was with the Father, when we are living faithfully and, you know, sort of tuned into Christ, we literally help make Christ manifest.
Mm.
Christ can be revealed through us. We know that's not saying anything new. But again, it goes to how often do we actually think of ourselves in that way as a carrier of Christ? And that again is our constant calling and purpose regardless of what else is changing.
Mm.
Continuity. Should we talk about Acts?
Yes.
Do you want to say something else about John?
Oh, well, only not about John, but I did just want to tap into Psalm 66, mm-hmm. which reiterates that abiding faithfulness of God. I cried aloud to him and he was extolled with my tongue. If I had cherished iniquity in my heart, the Lord wouldn't have listened, but truly God has listened. There's a real call in that psalm, a reminder of the faithfulness and enduring presence of God that just underscores what we were saying.
Thank you. So Acts 17, this famous passage that gets used in all sorts of ways in Christian apologetics, the Areopagus speech. Just want to say a couple of things here. I think one of the things this passage shows us, and it's stating the obvious, but it's also worth reminding ourselves of this, is that proclaiming the gospel is always culturally bound.
Mm.
It is always limited by the images and metaphors and language of a given culture, and Paul here is using his. And I think I don't really know how you would preach this per se, but I think it's a fantastic passage for preachers to reflect upon. Mm. And there's four things that struck me is Paul, he finds common ground with those he addresses. He finds some common connection points. He draws on human experience, so he doesn't negate their own experience. He actually draws on it and helps them, you know, brings to the fore what, again, some things they might all agree upon. And then he uses a whole lot of examples from their culture. He potentially is referencing here, or he, when I say he, Luke's writing up of it, so it's very literary, potentially is referencing here or alluding to quotes by two classical poets. So there's a reference to literature and poetry that's relevant to that culture.
Well, he says he's debating with Epicureans and Stoics.
Yeah. This is lofty conversation, if you like.
Yeah.
So maybe a reminder to those of us who preach now not to be afraid of lofty conversation with literary and artistic allusions and poetry.
Don't underestimate your community.
Yes. And then lastly, I'd say, having said all of that, he doesn't shy away from speaking gospel truth, which is countercultural, which in this case is the embodied resurrection that Jesus, you know, the promises to be embodied, which given the audience he's speaking to would be the shocking part of that we are resurrected as bodied, fleshly people, not souls that skip away to some higher place.
No, and he
place.
Doesn't compromise on that.
No.
Interestingly, he also doesn't use Jesus' name, I don't think.
No, he doesn't, which have led some people to say, how Christian is this? But if that's your definition of what makes something Christian, it's a little pedantic perhaps.
Yeah. I think there's also some sort of, I don't know, don't mean to be trivial, but a bit of a comfort for preachers. You know, some thought he was babbling. I mean, you know, basically people think we are babbling. Most of the culture thinks we're babbling.
You can imagine half the crowd rolling their eyes and going, what are you doing?
And the other thing about expectations is at the end, you know, some believe, where does it say? Some of them joined him and became believers.
Yeah.
Some of them scoffed.
Yeah.
We'll hear more about this. So there's something, you know, maybe occasionally we can have a nostalgic view about you know, this used to be all acceptable and everyone went along with it. Well, not at all.
No, no. And if that's what you remember, you perhaps remember a little blip of 1950s Australian Christianity.
Yeah.
Actually throughout the centuries, Christians have preached in the face of great scorn and scoffing and eye rolling and
so on. So
insults.
Now, Willimon has written a small book on preaching using this sermon. I think I'll put that in the show notes if I can find it.
We now have 58 books to reference in the show notes today.
I know, that's didn't have any last time and now we've got 58. But
but William is always worth reading on preaching. So
yeah.
We'll pop that down. We are out of time, but thank you for listening.
Yeah.
You've been listening to By the Well.
A podcast made with the support of the Uniting Church and Pilgrim Theological College. Thank you for listening.